three, two, three, four, four, two, three, and.
These men are pawns.
I put a price of 20,000 dirham on their heads.
Next, they will be hailed as the true messenger of God.
They were just a couple of songwriters who came to Ishtar to break into show business.
Easy boy.
What the hell's the matter with him? Is he blind?
Well, yeah, he is, but he's in perfect condition.
So how do they wind up on everyone's hit list?
Your life is in danger.
Behave normally. We have a gun pointed at your back. No, don't put your hands up, you idiot.
My little darling. My little darling.
I can't believe these men may control the fate of the Middle East.
Oh, man. How are you?
Do it.
Ay, 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 schmecker, but a hot for ya!
This is unbelievable.
Hoopa, hoopa, hoopa.
No, it will not. That my lover.
Oh! Are the two American messengers of God dead yet?
Is this the oasis?
Does this look like an oasis to you?
Yeah, look at the birds. Are those vultures?
Yeah.
For just... Oh, are you?
He's aiming at him.
Will you stop me? Paranoid! Transmuck! They're trying to kill us!
Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, Isabella Gianni.
Your girl! How did she get to be your girl?
Only you!
I think they're wonderful.
Ishtar. Written and directed by Elaine May.
This is some of our best work.
Hello. Welcome to Movie Umpers. My name is Bob Sham. How are you?
Hey, my name is Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Hey.
I'm fucking Sam. Don't tell my wife. Don't tell my wife. I'm fucking Sam.
You have a wife?
Is that okay with you?
I mean, somebody's got to cook, right? Well, I don't know why I'm a misogynist, dude.
I like my men misogynist. You like- when I'm cheating on my wife with other men, I need them to be misogynist. Yes, I'm Bob. That's Sam. The sounds you hear may be dogs. You're watching and listening to Movie Humpers, a show where we review movies with a monthly theme, and it's a whole new month, whole new theme. And we're calling it Awkward Laughter 2. Because we did an Awkward Laughter last year where we watched a few, what do you call them, slapsticky comedies? And for Awkward Laughter 2, we're going to reevaluate some movies that did not hit in their time for a variety of reasons, that were flops at the box office. And,
yeah, bro.
And take a look back to see how they hold up. Are they as bad as people said they were? A lot of these movies, you know, they are not necessarily bad, but just have a reputation of no one going to see them. And to quote, to roughly quote Elaine May, who directed this movie we're discussing, if everyone who hated Ishtar saw it, I would be a rich woman. That's right. We're talking about the movie Ishtar from 1987, directed by Elaine May, her fourth and last directed feature. She had made a few comedies before that were pretty critically well-regarded. And then we go on to Ishtar, in which she had a big budget, got a green light with the help of her friend Warren Beatty, who she worked on some scripts with. And yeah, this movie had a huge budget and a lot of rigmarole on the production here. It became kind of this Hollywood legend as this movie was being made, how much money it was costing. The directors and the actors maybe fought a bit. Apparently now everyone's kind of cool and they look back on it with fond memories. But there was some contention going on. And Elaine May is one of those directors, kind of like a Kubrick, that wants to do a lot of just like raw footage and a lot of reshoots and doing takes over and over and over again. And this movie became some kind of like meme before there were memes.
Yeah.
Like some weird joke. And I'm kind of wondering, and I did some, you know, reading. You could read the extensive production notes on Wikipedia and check the article links there. But I remember a Far Side comic by Gary Larson, who did, the cartoonist who did the Far Side. And he did this one, and he did those single panel comics. They're mm-hmm. still great after all these years. I still mm-hmm. enjoy them.
People used to have Far Side desk calendars.
Yes, I had a few. And there was one called Hell's Video Store.
Oh, yeah.
And it had the little Gary Larson characters walking around, and the only video they had in Hell's Video Store was Ishtar. And on an anniversary edition of the Far Side book, Gary Larson dedicated a page to that cartoon in which he said, I made this cartoon and then I watched Ishtar and I was pleasantly surprised and actually thought it was a really good movie.
Yeah.
There are a lot of cartoons I probably should apologize for, but this is the only one I'm going to actually apologize for.
Hey, I appreciate that.
Gary Larson backpedaled because he was kind of going on this. It's kind of like what Elaine May said. If everyone who hated Ishtar actually saw it, she'd be a very rich woman. He did what everyone else did. It became like this late night joke. The news of the production, the studio had changed, so there was some like misgivings about what was going on, but so much money was already made and there were politics behind the scenes and it overshadowed the movie itself. And it's hard to say why it flopped. There could be a multitude of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly think, you know, looking at this movie now that we've seen it in modern context, I can see like the audience at the time not really like getting this movie very well.
Yeah.
Elaine May wanted to make like an old style buddy comedy,
mm-hmm.
but it felt different at the same time. There's some aspects that she tried to dive into the tones of comedy past,
mm-hmm.
but when I'm watching it, it feels kind of ahead of its time.
It does, yeah.
In certain ways of execution and the politics of it. And one reason why it probably became this kind of proto meme of ultimate bad movie is that Siskel and Ebert both gave it thumbs down on their show.
They're laughing, and we're not, and that's late in the film, and we haven't been laughing, and when we see them laughing, it's offensive.
So I think we have a real good candidate for our worst 10 movies of the year right here. Yeah.
And declared the worst movie of that year.
That just feels like a massive overstatement.
Now, you can say what you want about any movie. We don't fucking care. And if they didn't like it, they didn't like it.
Yeah.
But after sitting through this movie, this notion that this is one of the worst movies ever made, I don't even think this movie's bad.
Not bad at all.
I think this movie might be a little better than good. In fact, objectively, I could say this movie, Elaine May and the cinematographer Vittorio Storaro actually made a beautiful fucking movie, especially once you get into the desert scenes. Now, like the way it's shot and there's certain things that occur, like there's a one point where the cinematographer sets it up and their blind camel kind of steps on his own rope mm-hmm. and heals himself and he goes to sit down and you see the guys in the background
mm-hmm.
and the way the helicopters are coming up over the dunes, like it's fucking beautiful.
It is very beautiful.
Like it's really well done. It's not a perfect movie. There are certain points we can cut to. Like it's got a few things that are tropey, but it's up to you how you want to interpret them. Mm-hmm. I think the movie kind of comedies are full of tropes, especially like there's the MacGuffin of a secret map that pertains of two people who might be help to overthrow this government that's backed by the CIA, mm-hmm. CIA that is challenged by this left-wing guerrilla group.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this map MacGuffin plot. And then at the end, there's that thing where, and this is actually pretty common in comedies, even coming up to today, where everyone comes together conveniently and it's kind of like the end of the movie and we resolve mm-hmm. things all collectively. It's a trope because it's not unique. It's a part of the comedy to almost lean into those tropes itself.
Especially if you're leaning into the old school way of doing comedy.
There's one scene that does kind of suck, and it's like the auction scene in the really desert. Sucks. In which Dustin Hoffman is just being more, like, loud than funny. He's pretending to be a guy who speaks Arabic or whatever, and he's just
saying a lot of babbling gibberish.
It's kind of one of those things that's like, oh, that relies on the Western sensibilities of not understanding anything about...
And it just goes on a little long.
Yeah, that part objectively sucks. I do agree with that. But beyond that, I don't have much notes here. Yeah, Ishtar, 1987, directed by Elaine May, written by Elaine May, starring Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty, Isabel Adjani, who we discussed in Possession, which is an S-tier, a certified S-tier banger, and Charles Grodin. I'm so glad we got a movie with Charles Grodin in it.
Me too.
Charles Grodin appeared in Elaine May. I think it's like her second
Heartbreak Kid.
Heartbreak Kid. So all these people have history. They all know each other. But this movie, it's about friendship, and it's about the passion of creativity and the desire to be a creative person. And this movie also defends, in a way, bad art. And I'm not saying that the movie itself is bad art. I'm saying that objectively, the characters of Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, Chuck Hawk Clark, he calls himself Hawk, and Warren Beatty is Lyle Rogers, are really terrible at what they do.
Yeah, but they're joyful. Art can bring joy to you even if no one likes what you're doing.
They're trying to be songwriters and thus performers to get their songwriting out there, but they're terrible.
Yeah.
And we got like the first 20 minutes of this movie. We do get this, the change of setting in this movie is pretty stark. And you do kind of have to readjust the sensibility of it. It does kind of feel like two different movies to some degree.
Yeah, because you even, the first sort of chapter of this movie, they start kind of in the middle. And then they flash back to when they met each other, and then they catch back up to the middle where they have to make this decision of, do they go to Morocco or do they stay in New York or do they break up?
But the first 20 minutes of the movie is just them putting together songs and montages of them singing songs and performing in front of like a few people and it being terrible and singing bad songs to people that they're dedicating these songs to.
Their girlfriends both leave them because they either can't stand the music or because they can't stand how much time they're spending together.
Carol Kane is as Dustin Hoffman's girlfriend
in
this movie. She's like too much of a bit character in her time. I feel like she could have gotten more. And this woman, like, honestly, you look back and I just forgot how much of a crush I used to have on her as a kid. Like, she is such a beautiful woman, right?
She really is, yeah.
She, Carol Kane, you'll probably remember. She had a role in Scrooge. She's always playing kind of like these weird, quirky, unhinged women sometimes.
Yeah, she was the mom in License to Drive. She had all these like bizarro little roles.
The first 20 minutes of this movie is fucking hilarious.
Absolutely.
Lip smacking, back slapping, perfectly delicious. No. Hot fudge love, cherry ripple kisses. Lip smacking, back slapping, perfectly delicious. What's the matter, honey?
Like, we're watching this shit and we're laughing our asses off.
I'm looking for software. I gotta have software for my machine.
And they're putting together these goofy little songs.
She said, come look, there's a... She said, come look, there's a wardrobe of love in my eyes. Take your time, look around and see if there's something your size.
And I think also what helps now is we have more of an expanded understanding of things like autism and Asperger's. And I think that really explains Warren Beatty's character in this movie.
Oh my God. This guy says he's a songwriter and he loved my song. He says he wants to buy me a drink. I'll be right there.
I think he has Asperger's. And
yeah, at the time, I feel like people would have just said he was dumb.
Well, they are dumb.
They are dumb.
They are both very stupid. That's another thing that kind of is different.
Delusional, too.
They got heart. You're not delusional if you're heartfelt. But they are fucking dumb. They are completely stupid. That is objectively true. And that's kind of what's different from the old buddy comedies. Some guy might be more swaggery and the other guy a little bit more physical, goofy. But these guys are just both just fucking dumb. They're full of heart. They're sweet. But they are stupid.
Well, and Dustin Hoffman wants to be the suave ladies man, and he even like tells people that he is, and Warren Beatty like pumps him up about it. He's always like,
yeah, but you gotta have the looks, Chuck. I mean, you walk into a place like that and the girls just want you, you know? You got that kind of face, kind of mean looking but with character. And the way you walk, you can only do that with a small body. Did you ever hear of a big sports car?
You're like a small guy. I'm too big. Like, I'm too big. I'm like a goof. Girls don't like me.
It's the Hawk character. He's the one that's pushing more of the delusion. But it falls apart because at one point he's on a ledge because he understands, like, he does have a passion for what he's doing, but he does feel like a fraud. And it takes Lyle's character. He's the guy who's just kind of so simple and straightforward. And he's kind of the one that keeps him in balance and keeps him on the track.
He is. He's like the straightforward Southern boy who went to New York to try to be a songwriter. But the thing about Dustin Hoffman in that scene that you just mentioned, Hawk in that scene, his girlfriend leaves him and he calls Lyle and he says,
Lyle, I'm outside on the ledge of my apartment.
What?
I've been fooling you, Lyle, and I've been fooling myself. I don't have any talent. I don't have any money. I'll never find Miss Wright, and Carol left me. Lyle, I can't make anything work. Everything I told you is fake. It's all make-believe.
I'm a failure. Everything I've told you is a lie. I'm not who I said I am. I'm a total screw-up. Don't call the cops. Don't call the cops. Don't call the cops. I'm on the ledge of my building. And he's sitting in the window. He's not out on the ledge. He's sitting in his window. And then the cops show up.
I'm finally on the ledge. I'm finally on the edge of my life. When the tears won't even come, when the pain is so big, I'm finally on the edge of my life.
And he jumps onto the ledge and runs out the side. And there was, like, he's so dramatic. I mean, I believe that he was upset. I don't know whether he wanted Lyle to call the cops so he could do that whole thing, or if he really didn't want Lyle to call the cops and he just wanted Lyle's sympathy. Like, it's hard to know because he is kind of dumb, and maybe that's giving him too much credit. But Lyle did have to go out on the ledge and walk him in, and they have this really sweet moment where Lyle's basically holding him and going, you have me.
Yeah.
We have music. Like, who cares if you've never done anything with your life?
It takes a lot of nerve to have nothing at your age. Don't you understand that? Yeah, most guys would be ashamed. But you've got the guts to just say the hell with it. You say that you'd rather have nothing than settle for less. Understand?
That's really brave to be your age and never have done anything with your life.
I think one thing that's really interesting here is that apparently Elaine May co-wrote a lot of the music with Paul Williams, a famous songwriter. And Paul Williams is on record saying that he's had the most fun on a movie writing songs for this because he wanted to write songs that they're not like, you're not trying to make like a spoof song. You're trying to make a song that's somewhat sincere that is actually bad. So you can imagine like that's how much fun that would be for a songwriter. Mm-hmm. He and Elaine May wrote out entire songs. When we see them doing performances, we're only seeing like a few lines, like funny lines.
My favorite.
If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band.
Shit, man, when you're on, you're on.
If Elaine May shot Kubrick levels of full scenes and footage, that means there's just straight, you could probably put together a full concert video of just the Lyle and Chuck characters just performing these songs. And can we get that a Criterion release of that with the supplements being just the straight full-on performances at the what's that nightclub in
the Shea Casablanca.
The Shea Casablanca.
We will pay full price.
Yeah.
For that Criterion.
I don't think it's too much to add. I don't think we're going beyond our bounds to ask for a Criterion Ishtar. I think the reputation of this movie lends itself to a mark in film history, and that should be good enough for a Criterion point.
I think so, too.
Now, do I really think they should probably put out Who Framed Roger Rabbit first or The Thing on Criterion? But honestly, I would set those aside if Criterion just put out an Ishtar with full concerts in the supplements. So get started on that.
like crackers from a barrel. That's when the morning.
So they're going nowhere.
They're going nowhere. They get an agent. It's funny because when we hear them trying to pound the songs out, they kind of harmonize a little. They're like, they're not great singers, but they kind of sound all right at first. And then they get in front of a crowd and they just sound like complete shit.
Well, and their thing is they don't want to be singers and performers. They want to be songwriters. And they want famous people to sing their songs. And their agent says, you got to be a singer for people to hear your songs.
Yeah.
You have to perform.
And the singer, I mean, the singer, the agent at first says, like, how would you like to play in Honduras, though it's, you know, politically kind of dangerous there right now.
Just don't
go
out at night.
But then he says, but think about it. We'll get you into North Africa. Like, the agent doesn't know where that Honduras is.
Well, he says Honduras,
else.
And then he says Morocco. He, like, gives them a couple different cities they could go to.
Well, after they've kind of lost their girlfriends and have kind of spread their savings thin, they're still together. So they're like, let's go to Morocco. Well, they end up in this country called Ishtar. It's a made-up country. There is no Ishtar, but it's fictionally placed between like Morocco and Libya or something.
Yeah.
And they go to this country and they immediately at the airport, the Chuck character meets Isabella Gianni, who's supposed to be dressed up like a man, and he doesn't know.
Oh, like a man, like me, like I'm a man.
Yeah. And he to show that she's a woman, lifts up her, because she's disguised, and shows that she has breasts.
How many times do you think they made her do that? Hold on. So yeah, like, I'm a dude, but watch this. Dude.
She takes off her Best Pro Shop trucker cap.
Whoa.
Did you know that I was Angela that whole time?
I did not.
Guys.
I feel embarrassed.
If you haven't seen Ishtar, that is how my costume was on par with Miss Johnny's costume. This is a gorgeous...
At Johnny.
This is a gorgeous woman who does not look like a boy. She's dressed like a boy, but girls dress like boys sometimes.
Do you ever see that National Geographic photo of the Afghani woman with the blue eyes, like the piercing blue eyes?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And Johnny just looks like a lighter-skinned version of that lady in this getup. Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman does end up being the lead, essentially, though... Warren Beatty's right on his heels. He seems to kind of give Dustin a lot for because these are like, we haven't really delved into it, but these were like the huge stars of their time.
Oh yeah, Dustin Hoffman had already done Tootsie.
This is like if you got like, what would be equivalent today? Like if you got George Clooney and Sean Penn or something, or. Something like that, or maybe that's a little dated.
Yeah.
What are two major stars you would put like?
So like you would get like Ryan Gosling and Michael B. Jordan.
I don't think they would do a very good job, but
I'm not saying well.
But
oh,
no.
You were trying to think of funny people.
I said George Clooney and Sean Penn. Sean Penn's not funny.
No, he's not like, at all.
I don't think that guy's ever been funny in his whole life.
I also don't know where he's been for a while, so.
But the point is, these are major stars in this kind of what the studios would later deem like some weirdly experimental film.
Yeah.
But Warren Beatty's character of Lyle, he's just kind of clueless. And he's terrible with women. He loses his girlfriend and it breaks him up. And he's just kind of this like he's a sweet guy, but he's kind of a sap. That is the opposite of Warren Beatty. Like this guy fucked like half of your favorite movie stars from like the 30-year period that he was active in movies. He was sleeping with Isabelle Adjani in this movie and was a
during this movie.
During this movie, which of course he was. Of course Warren Beatty was. But it's just so funny how Warren Beatty, he's just totally against, I mean, as any actor would want to do, totally against his actual type.
Yeah.
He's, because in reality, he's a complete himbo. So they arrive in Ishtar and Chuck loses his jacket and Isabella Gianni convinces him to trade jackets in a suitcase and she can meet up with him later.
So he's going to take her suitcase into Ishtar and she is wearing his jacket and has his passport. She tells him, oh, just go to the embassy. They'll give you a new passport. And embassy's like, it's Friday. No, yeah. You can't have this right now. And so Chuck says to Lyle, go to Ishtar. You have to go. You have to perform our show. We can't lose this gig. It's the only money. We have no money. We're here without money. Mm-hmm. So he goes. So he goes to a hotel and in comes babyface Charles Grodin.
Yeah.
Love him. He comes in and we find out he's a CIA agent and he basically pulls Chuck in.
American comes over. We ask him to keep his eyes and ears open for us and we pay him a little something. You'd be surprised how many harmless conversations are really the first step toward recruiting agents for left-wing organizations. A guy comes up to you and he starts talking about the poverty, the injustice in Ishtar, and there is poverty and injustice in Ishtar.
Of course.
He could be sincere. He could be saying exactly what he means.
Sure.
Or he could be feeling you out. That's right. Right. That's right.
Right.
And says, we'll get you to Ishtar, but we also need you to, you know, keep your eyes open. You're kind of like working for us, you know? Yeah. We need you to keep your ear to the ground.
Of course, you reflect upon the American history of politics in North Africa and the Middle East, and there's just, it's all just even funnier. But it also makes the ending even more ridiculous, but it's still just a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, they're getting all split up, and but Isabella, Johnny's character, Shira, does eventually recruit Lyle to the cause.
It's because Chuck gets to Ishtar because Charles Grodin helps him get there. And he has all this money and he gets there. And so he puts his suitcase in the room. And she tries to sneak in the room to find the map that she hid in the suitcase, she thinks, because her brother had the map.
And Lyle's an idiot too. So she thinks that this beautiful, fair-featured-eyed person is a boy. And then, like, fills their chest.
Are these breasts?
He's, like, got his hands all over her chest.
And, yeah, well, we know they were dating.
I know, but at one point she actually is like, can you stop? Like,
But, yeah, because, and he also saw Chuck stash money, and the CIA is paying him double what they were going to make on the gig.
Yeah.
So, when Lyle sees him stashing money, he knows Chuck's hiding stuff from
him.
And
she's already said, like, Chuck is working with the CIA, and he's like, no way Chuck is doing that. But then he knows he is, and he tries to go meet her, but Chuck follows him.
She gives him instructions to go to, like, a camel dealer and ask for a blind camel.
But she says, go to this place and ask for Muhammad. And when he goes and asks for Muhammad.
Muhammad.
I'm Muhammad.
You're kidding. You're Muhammad.
Of course, eight guys turn around.
Everyone turns
genuinely
around.
Genuinely funny.
And I love this part when he's like, I need a blind camel. You're Muhammad. I need a blind camel. And this guy comes, after a minute, this guy comes up and he goes, okay, we found you a blind camel. We also have a camel with a bad leg. Would you like also a dead camel? Like, he's like trying to load onto him all of his camels that are not perfect.
And he never actually meets the guy that he's supposed to give this to.
No.
Like, there's like multiple intelligence sources that are watching them all. And they're all incompetent. And yet everyone knows what everyone is doing.
But yeah, there's one point where the guys working with the CIA are talking to each other and calling out like, oh yeah, the guys with the Bermuda shorts, they're from this country. And the guys in the Hawaiian shirts, they're from this country.
Yeah, yeah.
The guys that are dressed up like they're from here, they're actually Americans. Like, and there's just this whole thing. And interestingly, you know, Chuck has followed him this whole time and they split up because Warren Beatty thinks he's being, Lyle thinks he's being secretive and he's not. And so Chuck is watching him through a window and here comes Shira. Shira?
Yeah. Yeah.
And she basically says to him, I know you're working with the CIA.
And he is, even though he's barely,
but
you know,
he hasn't told them about her.
Right.
But they know because they're the CIA and they've been watching him. They approached him because they knew that she approached him. They've been watching this whole time somehow.
Yeah, Lyle never meets up with the guy because it's supposed to be a code, but he literally had a guy sell him a blind camel.
Here's a red scarf I got for practically nothing.
What are you doing with a camel?
Oh, that's a long story. It's one of the things I bought.
What do you mean?
Huh? Well,
you bought a camel?
Well, yeah. Well, no, I didn't actually buy them. They sold them to me. But
huh?
Here, come on, boy. Easy, boy. Easy, boy. Easy, hey. Fella. Easy, boy.
What the hell's the matter with him? Is he
Sorry.
Blind?
Well, yeah, he is, but he's in perfect condition.
Yeah.
So they're walking around the streets with an actual blind camel.
Yeah, and so then they have to get all in disguises. And, you know, Chuck has met with the CIA guy again. Everyone's meeting in this place. Somehow everyone's always in the same place. And so Shearer says to him, like, I don't have the map. I thought the map was in the luggage, but I don't know where it is. I don't have it. And so because I don't have it, I'm probably going to die. And so he's worried about her because they're both in love with her. And then he goes down to meet Lyle, and Lyle's got this blind camel. And Chuck's like, go put on this outfit. Go behind this building and put on this outfit so no one will recognize you, because obviously we're Americans. And so Lyle goes to get an outfit on. Meanwhile, the CIA guy comes out to talk to Chuck and is like, they've decided they just need to kill them. And also, Shira's guys have told her that they need to kill them, but no one wants to actually kill these guys. They want to just, like, send them into the desert to die.
Yeah, well, Charles Grodin, you know, he's trying to make the guy, the ruling power, the emir, he talks to him, and he's like,
oh, Your Excellency, must we go through this? These men are pawns. Their only use is as a link to Shira selling the map.
Jim, I know nothing of any of this. However, when two Americans on their way to Marrakesh arrive in Ishtar by way of Air Canary and within minutes make contact with the most haunted fugitive in the country and give her a passport, I would hardly call them pawns.
They're pawns.
Soon their escape will be called a miracle.
They literally are representing something that could make the people believe that God is willing my overturn. Like, no. Look, nothing personal here. I'd rather you guys do it, but if you don't, then we will do it.
Yeah, it's like this prophecy of these two messengers who are going to come with this map.
And then at one point, the CIA is like, they seem to be, what they can represent seems to be way too volatile, and they kind of agree, like, maybe we should just kill these guys. And then the guerrilla group that Shira is working for is like, these guys, they could give way too much information about what's going on here. They may be way too inconvenient to keep alive. We may have to kill them. And Charles Grodin's character, I mean, he concedes because at the end of the day, he's an agent, but he doesn't really want to kill them. And Shira doesn't really want to kill them either. So they're both, at least, Shira's always trying to keep them alive. But Charles's character of Jim Harrison, he tries it first, but he can't maintain.
So Jim Harrison, the CIA guy, says, okay, you guys just start walking in the desert, walk like this far this direction, you'll find an oasis, we'll come and pick you up. What? That's a lie. Also, Shira tells Lyle at the same time, like, she helps him get all dressed up in his disguise, and she gives him these necklaces with these beads on them, and she tells him, go this direction until it gets dark and drop these beads as you go and they will glow in the dark. And he says, what about the wind? And she says, there's no wind in the desert.
Which is a lie. She just wanted to get him out of town before he would get killed.
But everyone thought, I mean, she kind of was like trying to give them a chance, but everyone's sending them into the desert to die because those beads don't glow. No. There's wind, you know, they're only going to have so much water. Like, so everyone just basically sending them out so they don't have to pull a trigger.
And before we get into the desert, like, there's still a couple of funny, like, there's a big shootout between all these intelligence agencies when they tried it, and they're accidentally killing each other. It's so funny how incompetent everyone is, despite also being really good at intelligence. They always seem to know. Charles Grodin's character has given Chuck a tracking device.
Oh, but they're following him like 5 feet behind him. Like every time he turns, a bunch of guys go like,
yeah, when they first are, when they're first leaving their hotel room, and Lyle does not trust Chuck there very much, and they're trying to separate so Lyle can go ask for the blind camel. There are people there that are obviously intelligence operatives, but pretending to be panhandlers or dudes on the street corner, and they're literally like all in a line following them, and they're arguing back and forth and causing traffic jams, and they're looking at each other, but they're not looking at the people who are obviously intelligence that are following them everywhere.
Yeah,
it really does play out very funny.
It is really funny.
But they go out into the desert, and yeah, they were both told to get out of town just to save their own fucking ass.
And this is when they have time, because they're alone in the desert, to sort of accuse each other of what they think each other's doing and get down to the bottom of the fact that they both have been meeting with Shira, and then they kind of fight over her a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's this one part where, well, they eventually figure out, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, I know we can talk about different things, but they find the map is in the back of the jacket.
Right.
And there's this really sweet part where Chuck's like, I'm gonna take this back to Shira and it's gonna save her, and Lyle's like, can I give it to her with you? Like, he just wants to Like, now he thinks, like, there's no way I'm going to get her, but can I just, like, be there so I can look at her?
I love the scene where the blind camel's just walking in circles, and the CIA sees the tracker of, like, a little dot, and they're like, what the fuck are they doing?
Oh, and also the camel stepped on Charles Grodin's foot and broke it, so he's got a broken foot for the rest of the movie.
And then the desert is also where the arms dealer auction scene, we went over that.
It's bad.
But
but because of that, they end up with guns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So eventually they do get the order. Jim Harrison can't push back any longer. He's got the order to kill him. They made it through the night. Yeah, they survived. So he's like, well, they got to kill him. They don't know they've got the map. Everyone wants this map. So, and like we said before, beautifully shot scenes. Mm-hmm. Helicopters are coming in. And that's when Shira shows up and this cabbie kid that helped them out earlier in the movie. And they roll up onto them in the desert and they help them shoot off the CIA by shooting back at them and shooting like RPGs at them and shit. And the CIA has to fucking just run away.
I love, like, she's a small woman, okay? And I know she's like part of the
resistance,
but she's a little tiny woman and she looks like Dustin Hoffman and she goes,
do you know how to use a grenade launcher?
No.
What? This is a trio. Let them come in closer. When I give you the signal, stand and fire. I have wrote about your deaths. We will die together.
But they fight them off.
And they manage to get out, but then we kind of cut to the end, and it kind of all cleans up in the sense that they give
their agent back in America has the map and is now talking to Charles Grodin. Yeah, so he's basically like, here's, if you want this map, here's our demands. Shira has to get something. They're trying to overthrow the emir, like whatever her resistance wants, they need to get. And the boys, they need an all expenses paid live show that starts in the Shea Casablanca, and they want it recorded. They want a live record, and you, the government, have to fund it.
This map is such a MacGuffin that it causes the U.S. government to be like, fine, we'll back the left-wing militia, which is the most unbelievable part of the movie, let's be honest. They would have assassinated the agent and the two men easily.
But then Charles Grodin goes, yeah, we have to give her what she wants, but the bigger thing is we have to promote this record.
And then we end on like a montage of them performing all of their songs at the Shea Casablanca.
And it's a bunch of army dudes who are supposed to pretend to be an excited audience.
Yeah.
And no one is liking this show except
for Shira.
And she is like crying. Also, she walks into the middle of this room with all these army dudes. And she's the only woman, and she's totally just being herself. Like, she's, I guess at this point, they've given her what she wants, so she's not in hiding. But right. It just seemed crazy that she just walks in a cocktail dress.
What is it?
I think they're wonderful.
Telling the truth can be dangerous business. Honest and popular don't go hand in hand. If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band.
This movie's fun as hell. I thought it was funny, and I think you can really analyze the nature of the characters and how dumb they are. It seems a little ahead of its time with a lot of comedies we get later, like Dumb and Dumber, or
absolutely,
like Dude, Where's My Car? And this movie is at least as funny as that, if not
absolutely
more.
Absolutely. I never saw Dude, Where's My Car, but
yeah, this idea that this is like an all-timer bad movie.
No way.
I don't get it.
No way.
For one, it's too well shot.
Yeah.
To be that bad.
And there's so many good people in this movie.
And if you're not laughing your ass off in the first half hour of this, at least, I don't know. Like, I think it's just a matter of the troubles getting it made overshadowed it actually, you know, how people received it.
Yeah, and what's so interesting about it is that funny, but there, because of the way these characters are written and acted, there's an earnestness to this that you don't get in other comedies later, like your Naked Guns and your Hot Shots and things that you might be like, oh, well, that's just dumb humor, which you can say about this, but there's a heart.
Yeah, like they are dumb as shit, but they are very heartfelt for sure. And all the music stuff is just funny as shit to me. Like, I just love how terrible they are. I mean, I know you got the stories of a lot of contention, and everyone involved in this movie, the big players, are still friends, as I understand it. But yeah, the movie feels fun to me.
And when we get older and we have a 50-year wedding anniversary, I would like to play the song that he sings for the couple at the beginning that he wrote.
Leaving soon, love in my will. Yes, I'm leaving some love in my will. My life is nearly over and time goes by so fast. And I wanted to give you a present to thank you for the past.
All right, you're going to give this 1 through 5. I'm going to give this 1 through 5 combined for best out of 10. For our first movie selection for Awkward Laughter 2, The Flop, what do you give Elaine May's very criminally underrated Ishtar from 1987?
3.75.
I'm going to give it a 3.75.
Yeah, so 7.5 feels really good.
It's honestly a higher score than most on this movie. You know what? No, fuck it. I'm sneaking this up to an A. I'm giving it a 4. It's a 7.75. Yeah, I gave Ishtar a 4.
I love it.
God damn it, it's a 4. It's good.
It's an A?
Yeah, it's an A.
Hell yeah.
Ishtar. Justice for Elaine May. Justice for Ishtar.
Justice for Ishtar.
All right, take a look there. It joins the Hall of A. It's an A-tier movie nestled between Inside Llewyn Davis and Jericho from 1937.
I love it.
It's Elaine May's Ishtar. Hell, it might even be better than that. If you think it's better than that, yeah, I'll let you roll with it.
Hell yeah.
If you think it's worse than that, you're fucking wrong. Ishtar, very underrated. Very underrated. Check the show notes for links and other places to find us. We got a lot more awkward laughter selections, more flops that we're going to be reevaluating. I'll throw that picture up, like you can see on the side, a little list of the movies we're going to be discussing this month. Check that out. Study it. It's a bit of a preview. And you'll see what's next on the list after Ishtar. Yeah, we're talking about Cabin Boy, the Chris Elliott flop, comedic flop with Andy Richter. And a cameo by David Letterman to host the Academy Awards or the Oscars. I don't know what he hosted. I think it was the Oscars, that you had to have at least appeared in a movie. Letterman hadn't at the time, but he appeared in Cabin Boy. All right, so check the show notes for links, other places to find us. And like, subscribe, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of Ishtar. If you think it's a bad movie, I mean, type what you want, but you're wrong. But if you're like, if you want to discuss how good the movie is, I'm all ears. Let us know. All right? So until next time.
Justice for Ishtar.
Applaud! Encore! Applaud! Encore!
This is unbelievable.
What is it?